The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. From the heights of the post-racial hype following the election of the first black president, more recently, the myth of a society that has moved past its race issues has been shattered again and again. From protests in Ferguson, Missouri, to Baltimore, Maryland, to the deaths of 9 black churchgoers at the hands of a white supremacist in South Carolina, these events have reopened an uncomfortable national conversation on race in America. It's a conversation that our guest today on The Exchange is keenly aware of as president of the Manchester branch of the NAACP. We're sitting down this hour with Willard Lett. He's been with the organization for about 20 years and began his term as president in January. This hour, we'll talk about his work on these issues and how they're playing out in New Hampshire and his city of Manchester. And let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Willard Lett, welcome to The Exchange. Good to see you.
Good morning. Good morning.
Well, let's talk about South Carolina right off the bat, because that's really still fresh in people's minds and a big concern. One activist in Los Angeles, Willard, said after the South Carolina shootings in the church, "This sets us back 50 years. Race relations are going out the window." What do you think?
You said it was an activist. I'm not familiar with that particular quote. However, I would say that what happened in South Carolina is an extreme example of a ongoing narrative within American society. You know, the kinds of ideas, the kinds of activities and things that we see in the form of the Tea Party. And there was a young guy who just recently wrote a book called Dog Whistle Politics, where he talked about how in current times, and particularly he pointed back to Reagan and Nixon, where there is a antagonism that's promoted around this idea of race to divide people. So I think that it's particularly tragic and horrific. However, I think it's more the same. It's a matter of degree rather than a matter of kind.
Do you think this sets race relations back? This South Carolina incident, and we'll talk later about the, you know, controversy over police tactics. But in terms of this one incident, you know, how does this affect relations between people of different races, especially blacks and whites?
Well, you know, I think that your question really hits on the problem, and it hits on the problem because it presupposes several different things. One, it presupposes that there is a such thing as race, and that's a fundamental problem in American society, based in you know, the history of the European experience that sets the stage for these kind of outcomes. It's well known, and I won't go too far, but I'll just say it's well known that there's no such thing as race. They sequenced the human genome, didn't find anything that would allow for the kind of arbitrary separation that we have and that we use in terms of talking about race. So the fact that we have this imaginary idea in people's heads and the implications, both what it connotates and denotates, you know, about people's interest and even people's abilities, kind of propels us in this direction where someone could feel that it was okay to do what they did.
So you're getting to what some people say, Willard, that race is a social construct, not a biological construct.
It's
what we make of it.
Yeah. And yes. The short answer is yes.
You know. You can give me the long answer if you want.
I say I'll concur. You know, we reached the same conclusion. You know, maybe not exactly. I wouldn't state it that. But yes, there is no such thing as race, you know, and that's a problem. It's a problem that that idea is promoted. It's promoted in as part of the dominant narrative, you know, in common language and dialogue and government documents. We have this idea, you know, that. And in fact, you know, we had to create this idea was created to allow people to feel that it was OK to treat humans as property. You know, you had to convince people like, hey, these people are less than human. So it's OK to treat them that way. You know, and that same thinking, that same idea entered that church in South Carolina that said, hey, these people are less than human. It's OK to slaughter them.
How do you explain what happened in South Carolina to an African-American child? You have kids and you have grandkids.
Yeah. You know, I think that we have to say that it's an extraordinary event. It's sort of like explaining an earthquake or a tornado. There's a car crash and the family is killed, someone that you know. You have to tell them that, hey, you know, this is an example of something that is horrible, it's terrible, but it's limited to, you know, it's limited. We got to go on. We got to live. We got to go on with our life. Yeah.
How did you sort through it yourself as an adult and as somebody who's, you know, worked in this field for a long time?
Well, you know, I recognize clearly from the time that I've spent as an adult and as an older adult, you know, the time that I've spent going through life, it's become clear that there are certain kind of, I tell people in talking about these kind of things that, you know, we all have these things called paradigms, the ways that we look at the world that are informed by certain assumptions. You know, at one time, people subscribed to the paradigm that the world was flat. You know, you don't want to sail too far away from, you know, you got to keep land in sight. Otherwise, you fall off the edge of the earth. You know, at one time, people subscribed to the paradigm that the sun circled around the earth. You see it come up in the east, set in the west, you know, come up the next day. And so that, you know, it was apparent that this was the way that things are. I think that similarly in relationships, in human relations, as we interact and relate to each other, with all of the stuff that goes on, I explain it to myself by saying that, you know, some people are working and some people are a little bit off point. You know, they're not totally in understanding exactly what's going on or what's happening.
Can you give me a little bit more on that?
Well,
what is it that they don't sort of understand?
Well, I think that the major lack thing that's misunderstood is based around the history and the experience here in the U.S., social history and experience, and around this idea of race. You know, most people don't understand here in the United States that in its early founding, the people that we call the 1% now, you know, were the 1% of that day. They were bringing people over from Europe who were indentured servants. You know, Europeans and Africans were indentured servants around 1676, Bacon's Rebellion. And there was a racial compromise where, you know, we're going to put this particular group of people into permanent bondage. And as a way of justifying that and treating them as property, we got to convince ourselves that they aren't human. And that is still a dominant narrative. You know, we see that with coming back even after the Civil War. You know, with the as our friend Douglas Blackman said, you know, slavery by another name, with peonage slavery and tenant farming and that kind of stuff. We see it with the W.D. Griffin, The Birth of a Nation, that they were just talking about, where these certain kinds of images are put out there and people become, you know, they become convinced that what they think is reality and they act it out.
I have one more question about South Carolina for you, and then I do want to move on to all the conversations about police tactics in Maryland, Missouri, New York. How much does it matter, Willard, that the Confederate flag no longer flies in South Carolina, or that Walmart or other major retailers won't sell it? And then I've got a Facebook comment for you on that as well.
Okay.
Does it matter?
Well, I think it does. You know, the Confederate flag is a representation of a terrorist organization. You know, the Confederacy was the ISIS of its day. You know, they had an extreme ideology, you know, one that was grounded in this and grounded and founded in this belief that people of African descent weren't human. You know, it was this profound idea that and so that Confederate flag continues to represent that in much the same way that the swastika represents the ideas of Nazi Germany. So, you know, if you support that, then you support those ideas and you give people license to act on those ideas.
How do you feel, Willard, when you hear people say in the South, no, no, this isn't condoning racism, but this is part of our history. It represents the valor of our Confederate soldiers.
Well, I you know, I don't agree. I think that, you know, in many ways, what we are seeing in the symbolism of the Confederate flag is this whole idea that, you know, of white supremacy and the efforts to maintain that, you know, in society. And in fact, the Confederate battle flag, what we're talking about is a Confederate battle flag. There was a Confederate flag. There is a Confederate state flag that most people aren't familiar with. We don't see. So if that was the case, then why not fly that particular flag? The Confederate battle flag came to prominence in response and reaction to the efforts and the demands of people of African descent for human rights during the 1950s and 60s.
Here's a Facebook comment from Len. And Len, thank you. He says, how is the removal of the Stars and Bars in South Carolina informing the NAACP with its next move? What can be done in New Hampshire? Len, thanks for the comment. How does he – I like his question about informing the NAACP with its next move. So it's coming down in South Carolina. Do you focus on other states or do you just say, okay, we're –
Well, I think that, you know, one thing that we have to say is that the NAACP at the local level is a volunteer organization that's comprised of, you know, local community members. And so we respond to local needs as based, you know, as expressed by those communities. There are a number of different NAACP branches around the country, like in Atlanta. You know, the Atlanta branch of the NAACP is saying that the Confederate the images of the Confederate generals that are on Stone Mountain should come down because it's public property and it shouldn't be, you know, promoting that. So there will be other this particular event and that took down the flag in South Carolina will inform people and they'll demand for more.
Well, and Len, thank you for the Facebook comment. And, you know, he asks, what can be done in New Hampshire? So coming up, Willard, maybe we'll talk about your work with the Manchester Police Department in response to the concerns that we've seen elsewhere in the country about police tactics in African-American communities. We'll also hear from you. So keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, our guest is Manchester's NAACP President, Willard Lett. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Willard, let's talk about the other big subject that has come up nationally and here in New Hampshire beyond the deaths of the black churchgoers in South Carolina, and that's police tactics around the country, concern, controversy over how African Americans, especially men, are treated by police. Your organization has been working with the Manchester Police on this. In fact, you serve on the Manchester Police Commission. What sorts of conversations are you having with the Manchester PD?
You know, it's when we look at the social role of the police, you know, oftentimes they have emblazoned on the side of their vehicles, we serve and protect. But in communities of African descent, traditionally and in contemporary times, the role of the police is command and control. And that becomes, you know, what they that has become how they view their role generally and becomes what they attempt to do. In Manchester, I think that the previous chief, Chief Mara, early on recognized and often stated that it's important for a police department to reflect the community that it serves. And so with that in mind, that he's done a lot of outreach to communities, going to community meetings, talking to vocal members of the community, and in that way has, I think, done some work to really he's done some of the groundwork that people are saying need to be done in many of these places where there are hot spots. Also, the other issue is that, you know, police are people. And so, and sometimes people make mistakes, and sometimes people do stupid things. And the Manchester Police Department has been receptive to being challenged and being taken to task when someone in the community feels like they have made a mistake.
Yeah, and after, you know, Ferguson, Baltimore, New York, and so forth, you know, the chief did say, "Let's create a groundwork, create a framework where these types of things don't happen in Manchester." But you're right, Willard. You know, people are people. Tensions get high. People are nervous. Maybe somebody's pulling out a gun, and then it turns out maybe it wasn't a gun. I mean, it's tough to in that fraught moment.
Yeah, and I'm saying that more than that, which is that it's not the moment. It's not even the moment that you know, where people are making split decisions. It's the environment. The police shooting in South Carolina, where the guy was running away and he was shot 6-7 times, the person that was shooting him was not in a fraught moment. It was command and control. You know, he's running away from me. My role is command and control. Just recently, there was a shooting where they shot in the car like 100 times. And then one of the police officers jumped on the hood of the car, shot into the car 17 times. And he said, "Oh, I was afraid for my life. So I ran up and jumped on top of the car." But again, it's this whole thing. They ended up shooting these people because they were driving away. Command and control. That was a shooting in Washington, D.C. for a woman, you know, with their children in the car. I think they said she was mentally ill or something. But the police told her to stop driving. She was driving. They killed her. Command and control. So that becomes a major feature, not so much something that would be unique to South Carolina and or New Hampshire. It was part of this national dialogue and this larger dominant narrative that frames and projects the idea that people of African descent are less than human, you know, and that, you know, that there's this thing called race that sets up this division of the human family, you know, where this group, so-called whites, are superior and this group, so-called blacks, are inferior.
Even with all the work that has gone on at the Manchester PD, do you think, Willard, that police are quicker to pull the trigger on a black person than a white person?
I think so, yes. I will say that. And even we say pull the trigger, but take action, any action. I mean, even when you look at, you look at the statistics, it bears it out that, you know, in certain communities, particularly communities that are low income and communities of color, they get more patrols because there's the assumption that there's more, illegal activity going on there. And because there are more police there, then, you know, more they have more opportunities to stop people. However, I think that, yes, it's the message that you get is that there's a problem with black people. In fact, people that we consider black. In fact, if you think back in around the early mid-50s, Kenneth B. Clark, a sociologist, did a test called the Dahl test. That test was replicated 5-10 years ago with the same result.
I'm familiar with that, but just tell our audience what that is because they might not know.
Where you take a group of children, 4, 5, 6-year-olds, and place them in front of two dolls. One doll is a brown doll, one doll is a pink doll, and you ask them a series of questions. Which doll is a good doll? Which doll is the bad doll? Which doll is pretty? You know, which doll is ugly? Those kind of things, and watch the children's reactions. And the children, pretty much, their reactions reflect the general dominant narrative that, you know, black people are bad, you know, not good. White people are good. You know, and so that if that happens to you as a child, when you become an adult cop, you're still carrying that.
I did read about that recently. Does that surprise you that the results of that Dahl test that you mentioned have not changed, even though we've got, you know, President Obama, Michelle Obama, very prominent, obviously?
No way does it surprise me at all, because you still got, I mean, you know, just you are in the media, and just about a week or so ago, there was all this praise lavished upon Birth of a Nation as a movie and its technological improvements. But there, you know, people don't even mention the sociological impact of Birth of a Nation, which was a rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan across the country. You know, it was fashionable and OK. And those same ideas continue to exist. It's Donald Trump and the birther movement questioning the legitimacy of President Obama's citizenship, and the Republican Party taking a position that they were going to do everything they could to ensure that the president doesn't have a successful candidacy, he wouldn't be reelected because he wouldn't be able to make any changes or any positive things for the nation.
Let's take some calls, Willard, okay. And then we'll talk some more. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. And Sandra's in Manchester. Hi, Sandra. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Sandra. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to ask Willard the stance that the Manchester Police Department has currently on some of the legislative demands that are currently being made regarding the police department. Including cultural competency of police forces, you know, whether or not other police officers locally will be engaging in ongoing cultural competency, as well as independent or special prosecutors when the police are subject to prosecution for serious crimes. It has presented a big problem when police officers are prosecuted by prosecutors who are local and who they're familiar with. And finally, the requirement for police body cameras. I'd like to know, you know, what is the response as far as the Manchester Police Department regarding those three things?
Okay. And Sandra, thank you very much for calling in. Cultural competency, Willard, for Manchester Police. This gets to the, you know, the whole training aspect that you talked about earlier.
Yeah. Well, the Manchester Police Department does have an ongoing cultural competency training program, and it goes back a number of years. They've been doing it for a while. And I think partly in response to the fact that Manchester was you can't discount the leadership within the police department, but Manchester was a refugee resettlement site. And so they've been doing the cultural competency training for a while, and they've even went and trained other departments in the state. The Manchester Police Department does not have wear body cameras. And I had talked to the police chief about this. The Regional Association of Manchester NAACP branches has come together to put together a program of police reforms that we're advocating throughout New England. And that is for body cameras, that there be independent or special prosecutors for police-involved shooting or misconduct charges and the cultural competency trainings.
So does NAACP support body cameras for police?
Yes. In fact, we are advocating for body cameras for police. And partly because, as everybody knows, that what we've seen the impact of having cameras on, police behavior, police conduct, and having some insight into what's going on. So, yes, I think that generally the Manchester Police Department, because we're in a small city, 100,000 is not a lot of people. It's big for New England, northern New England, but we're a little bit ahead of the curve. And at this point, they've been supportive of these ideas.
Well, Sandra, thanks for the call. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And here's an email from Kelly in Goffstown, Willard. She says, getting local, what are the challenges special to New Hampshire or more locally to Manchester? What are the organization's priorities here? In what ways is our situation different here? Kelly, thank you for the call. I wondered about that too, how your role here in New Hampshire, which is still a large majority white state, would be different than if you were the head of NAACP in Manchester, for example. Or would it be different? Maybe it wouldn't be.
As I mentioned before, the priorities of the branches are set by the local community members, you know, by the local members.
Doesn't come down from national.
It doesn't come down from national in terms of how we implement whatever programming that we're involved in. Here in Manchester, you know, our major activities are responding to complaints from citizens who felt like they've been mistreated, you know, through one of our committees called the Legal Redress Committee. We have a health committee that works at dealing with health issues and getting people involved in that. And also we have a political action committee that's looking at, you know, being promoting civic engagement. The different conditions that people live in or different places has different emphasis from time to time. I think one of the things about being here in New Hampshire that makes the experience of the NAACP here unique is the fact of the demographics of the state. You know, prior to moving here to New Hampshire, my only experience and my image of the NAACP was of a mild, reformist, conservative, you know, socially conservative organization. I came to New Hampshire and I found out people thought it was a radical organization. You know, it's like you say you're with the NAACP, people like, you know, clutch their purse and, you know, pull their jackets tight. And that's probably because of the, like I said, the demographics, the lack of but not only the demographics, even more importantly, it's the dominant narrative in the media.
The NAACP is a mild, reformist, conservative organization. That's how you thought of it before moving to New Hampshire.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it can, and even, and that continues to be true even being here. However, you know, people are so invested in the institutional arrangement of society that anyone talking about making any change is viewed as a threat and as a radical.
Is the NAACP, I'm talking national now, too mild for a younger generation of African-American youth, especially, who are just, you know, so angry over all these police shootings that we've seen?
Yeah, well, you know, I think your question touches on first I'll answer it, which is I don't think so. You know,
do you speak to that new generation?
Yeah,
that's what I'm trying to ask.
Okay. One of the things that as we, you know, if we pay attention to what the national NAACP is talking about, it's a support of reparations for people of African descent, you know, as a result of the crime against humanity of the African slave trade. And I think that idea among young people is fairly radical, you know. However, we find that in all institutions, you know, I think it was somebody who said that each generation has to find their own mission, their own, you know, their own way. And we see people falling away from many organizations, churches and other kinds of, you know, because the youth are in a different space and the economy is in a different place. So society is moving in a different direction. One of the things that we've done, that the organization has done, NAACP, both nationally and locally, is work to develop programs that reflect the concerns and the interests of young people. However, you know, one of the main things, we even saw it with one of the challenges that NAACP has, particularly with these police-involved shootings, is the way you characterize your question, which is that the NAACP is not really focusing on civil rights. It's focusing on human rights. You know, and so those shootings are human rights abuses. Those human rights abuses shouldn't be a concern only to young people of African descent. It should be a concern to all people of African descent. It shouldn't be their human rights abuses. They shouldn't be, the concern shouldn't be limited to people of African descent. It should be a concern for all people. You know, so that's part of what we have to, you know, we have to do is sort of open up the mission and the ideas and the relevance of the group in terms of explaining it to young folk. And part of explaining it to young people is, you know, keeping up with them long enough to with this, you know, the 5 minute, 10 minute news cycle.
Well, and lots of calls, Willard, so okay. I want to go to them. I guess one real quick last question on this idea of how a 106-year organization, you know, with a hierarchy and a structure and so forth, speaks to young people. The name itself, Willard, National Association of Colored People. Colored people, to some, might conjure up those images of separate bathrooms and separate drinking fountains, you know, labeled white and colored. I mean, is the name itself a problem?
I don't think so. I don't think that it's a problem. However, it wasn't my choice to maintain it. But, more and more as we go forward, they're coming into common language and the common usage is this idea called people of color, colored people, people of color. I mean, if one is a problem, the other should be as well, you know. And even though there may not be any signs, we're not too far from separate, you know, this whole thing of separate bathrooms, separate neighborhoods, housing patterns are just as, segregated as they were before. Education, look at what's going on in the prison.
And President Obama talked about that just yesterday, I think, at the NAACP meeting. I want to share you with our listeners, though, okay. Willard, lots of people who want to jump into our conversation. And Cecilia is in White River Junction, Vermont. Hi, Cecilia. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I'm calling because I am the parent of a 7.5-year-old daughter. And what can I do to prevent her from inheriting this national unconscious, attitude? It seems like it's a heritage that, just listening to the show earlier, that we're all bound to inherit. And what can I do to counteract that?
So here you it sounds like you're living in a white community. You're white yourself, Cecilia?
Yep, that's right.
So how do you keep your daughter from inheriting some of the attitudes that Willard's talking about? Thank you for calling. Go ahead, Willard.
Well, Cecilia, I think part of what you're faced with is a situation that reinforces these kind of ideas. Like our host today keeps using the term white. She said you were white. She said the community that you lived in is white. You're not white. You're human.
You're trying to get beyond that idea.
Well, we
got to
get
race.
Beyond that. We got to get beyond this idea that there is a such thing as race. And part of this idea is institutionalized in policies and practices so that while there is no such thing as race, there is a such thing as racism. You know, so, and what you got to, I think, Cecilia, you'd be best served by going out and trying to interact, exposing your daughters to different communities and being engaged.
All right. Cecilia, thank you very much for calling in. We'll take more of your calls, emails after a short break. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, our guest is Willard Lett, president of Manchester's NAACP. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Willard, before we go back to our listeners, just before the break, we were talking with Cecilia. She's wondering how to help her teach her daughter to not adopt some of the stereotypes that we have in America. And I feel like right. You need a little bit more time to finish up there.
Yeah. One of the things that the NAACP has done is partnered with the other organizations in the area. And on August 15th, there's an event called the We Are One Festival in Manchester, where the Latinos Unidos organization that founded this event called the Latino Festival and Ujima Collective that founded the African Caribbean Celebration have come together. And they are doing this music and culture festival in response to social isolation for people of African descent as well as Spanish speaking and cultural alienation because they don't have opportunities. You, Cecilia, and your daughter and these communities themselves don't have opportunities to see these cultures and the food, the dance. So August 15th in Manchester in Veterans Memorial Park is an opportunity to do that.
Cecilia, thank you for the call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. James is in Goffstown. Hi, James. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Can you hear me?
We sure can. James, go ahead.
Thank you. So just wanted to make an observation and get Willard to share a little bit more. Having grown up in Charleston, I went to school with people who had the Dixie flag in the back of their truck along with their guns. And knowing a bit about what they were thinking when they put those two artifacts in their trucks, they were not educated about what the flag really meant. And I think that's something we need to recognize, that education about what that flag really means is what is going to help, what is what help remove it from the state capitol, and it's what will change the way that people think about the flag and its usage.
James, thank you for calling in. Do you think people who fly the flag really don't understand what it means?
Yes, I would agree that people don't really understand what it means, because I think those same people that fly the flag, you know, when we use this concept of race, we're flying that same flag, because it was the same ideas that created the concept of race in order to separate people and privilege one and punish another group of people. It resulted in this flag saying, hey, we want to keep that system going. So, no, I don't. I do think that people oftentimes are confused. The dominant narrative in American society in many ways has a lot of those same features that are represented by the flag.
Okay. James, thank you for calling in. Here's an email from Newt in Effingham Falls, who says, advocacy groups must win over hearts and minds to be as effective as they can be. The NAACP's success in a lot of ways can be attributed to effectively telling their stories, making it impossible for white people of conscience to look away and compelling them to join the fight. But, Newt says, so many black people are turning away from the civil rights struggles of LGBT people. He says, how can the NAACP become a more effective partner to individuals and groups who are in the midst of struggles well understood by black people? Newt, thank you very much for the email. This is a big topic, Woolard.
It is. It is. And, you know, it's a controversial topic because we're talking about people. But I think, again, the way that our commenter put the terms of his discussion where he talked about white people of conscience need to be involved. That's not true, you know, that we want white people of conscience to be involved, you know, because first, there's no such thing as white people. And he talks about black people and their struggle. Well, there's no such thing as black people. They're human, you know, and we're not asking for the NAACP and people of African descent are not asking for charity, you know, give us this dispensation of civil rights and these privileges. We're, you know, asking for justice and saying that, you know, people of African descent were endowed with certain inalienable rights by their creator, which is life, you know, liberty and the pursuit of justice, and have a right to that just like any other human. And so, you know, that's what sets the stage. And while it's unfortunate that LGBT community now is feeling, you know, a lot of heat, you know, there would be much different relationship if the LGBT community as the LGBT community had came out in 54, 55, 60, 65, 70, when the Bakke decision came and stood for justice, you know, with people of African descent. So it's a two-way street. And the fact that, you know, the fact that the caller, based on the dominant narrative, is lumping all these people together in this group called black people, you know, is part of the error because, you know, I mean, there are LGBT people, you know, LGBT who are of African descent as well. So one of the things we got to do is we got to look for justice across the board.
Thank you for the email, Newt. And here's another one from Samson, who says, what's the percentage of African immigrants in Manchester, and how is the NAACP addressing their needs? Because most of us are new to democracy and in need of help on knowing the best enjoy of this great country, the USA. So again, this is from Samson, who by his use of the word us, sounds like he is a new African immigrant. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, the Manchester branch of the NAACP has worked closely with a number of different groups, both national and religious groups here in Manchester. We've worked with the Haitians through the Haitian Community Center. We've worked with the Bantu Somali and the Somali Development Center. You know, we work with the Sudanese from the north. We work with the Southern Sudan community. You know, we work with the Congolese. And so we work closely with a number of these folks, partly because there are two challenges. One, when these people come over here, when these people come from different countries to the U.S., they're judged by their appearance and they're sorted and slotted into these groups. And if you're from Africa, you're going to be considered black and you have to deal with the whole kind of social connotations and denotations of that in American society. So
and sometimes it's surprising for them.
Right. And actually, it's oftentimes it's not internalized. So it's like, hey, I'm Nigerian. You know, I mean, you're, you know, and so, but however, what we do is we respond to, we reach out to communities and we collaborate with them on different projects, and we respond to the needs when they have needs. And we also have a big challenge with education, educating them. You know, one of the things that, and like the guy was saying about the people of European descent in South Carolina, you know, one of the founding documents of the United States is this thing called the Constitution, where, you know, they say, where it says, like, we believe all men are created equal. And many of those folks that were signing that document were slave owners. So that contradiction still is part of, you know, the institutions in American society, and folk coming in from outside who don't have an understanding of this history oftentimes are looking for something that's not there. They're looking for a romanticized version of the American experience that's not there.
In terms of the newcomers to Manchester especially, but also, you know, Concord, Laconia, Nashua, are they becoming part of your organization, or are they saying, you know, NAACP, you know, you guys, no, we don't have a problem with you, but our experience is so different that we don't feel like we have enough in common to work with you? I'm just wondering how much you work on your own and how much you're working in concert with some of these newer arrivals.
Yeah, the degree to which they, which anyone, whether newcomers or old, you know, old residents of America, whether of African descent or of European descent, the degree to which they identify with the NAACP and become card-carrying members it depends on their level of insight and understanding of what our mission is and how that relates to their everyday life. There are a lot of people of African descent in the state who aren't members of the NAACP. There are a lot of young people who some born here and some, you know, being newcomers. But also for the people who are newcomers, their children aren't newcomers. You know, so when we start talking about, you know, what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, and what happened in Baltimore, we're talking about their children. Yeah, you're talking about my children, you know, because, you know, being born here in the U.S., but we're talking about their children, too.
Let's take another call. This is Mark in Wilton. Hi, Mark. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is how much cooperation or willingness have you gotten from the entertainment industry, particularly the music industry, to, you know, diminish the portrayal of black people as thugs and gangsters? There's, you know, my kids listen to a lot of rap, and, you know, inevitably when I watch videos with them, it's not the most endearing presentation. And I'm just wondering, you know, Hollywood talked about toning down violence in movies, gun violence, that sort of thing. What's coming from the rappers and that gangsta image? And I'll take your comments offline.
Mark, thanks a lot for calling in. Wow, this is a toughie. We could probably talk about this for hours.
Actually, it's not so tough. You know, the answer is pretty much straightforward. The images that the media put out now, today, are the same ones that were put out with Birth of a Nation. Same images, you know, the same ideas. And what happens is that, you know, the rappers that we're familiar with are the ones that corporate America chooses to fund and to pay. That doesn't mean that those are the only ideas out in the community. That doesn't mean that those are the only things that people are doing. It's the ones that corporate America picks up and promotes, you know, and the ideas that it propagates. And one of the reasons that that happens is because it sells. And one of the reasons that it sells is because it's familiar. You know, so you're doing the same thing over and over. So there are people who, you know, are presenting a positive. You heard Common. He's a grown man now, but the actor, rapper Common, you know, who was involved with the movie Selma and talked about, you know, his work. I think he did some work around that. But there are a number of different people who are positive, sending a positive message, but they don't get the major corporate support. So the question, again, is not a matter of charity. Like, well, what are the corporations doing, you know, as a favor to black people? You know, part of the challenge is that, you know, we're considering this group black people, which goes into the original construct of, you know, white supremacy, black inferiority. You know, we're not asking for charity from the corporations. We're asking for justice, you know, and that's why the NAACP is a supporter of the reparations movement for, you know, the victims of the of African enslavement in the U.S.
Let's take another call. This is Chris in Keene. Go ahead, Chris. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Thank you. Before I get to my question, I wanted to say there's a committee in Keene that's commemorating the 50th anniversary of Jonathan Daniels' assassination at the height of the Civil Rights Movement in 1965. And part of our observation is a free community screening of the documentary on Jonathan Daniels at the Colonial Theater on the evening of August 22nd, followed by a service at St. James Episcopal Church on Sunday. One of the things that Jonathan Daniels stood for was voter rights, and we've seen an erosion of voter rights with the Supreme Court decision. And I'm wondering, here in New Hampshire, there's an effort to roll back to have voter photo ID and also not to allow college students to vote in their college communities. And I'm just wondering what our guest feels about that.
Okay, Chris, thank you very much. And, you know, you talked earlier, Willard, about all that's on your plate. But is this on your plate as well in New Hampshire, or not so much here as it might be in other states?
Well, it is. It is on the plate because it's part of the, you know, the political environment. And I had the opportunity to participate in a press conference a couple of weeks ago prior to the legislation reaching the governor and being vetoed, in a press conference that dealt with voter suppression in conjunction with a number of different groups, the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union and other groups that where we talked about the problem with the voter suppression efforts, not only here in New Hampshire, but even nationally as part of this larger national agenda.
Is it voter suppression or is it the integrity of the vote? Bill Gardner, the well-respected Secretary of State here in New Hampshire, said, you know, that this 30-day residency requirement, for example, is okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, he may have said it was okay, but where are the examples, either here in New Hampshire or nationally, where there have been abuses, you know, either one around the voter photo issue where not if you don't have a photo ID, then you're supposed to take your picture in the polling place, you know, as part of the same day voting requirements, or even where students and generally this 30-day requirement will impact some students, but it'll also impact people who live here in New Hampshire. You can move from you know, one ward in Manchester to another and be negatively impacted by this this ruling. And there's no what's the basis for saying we need these restrictions on voting? We don't have the examples of abuse either here locally in New Hampshire or nationally as part of a larger what is it, ALEC, the American Legislative, you know, it's part of a larger packet of reforms that or of laws and approaches that we see closely related to the kind of Tea Party politics that we view as being represented by the Confederate battle flag.
Let's take one more if we could. And this is Amare calling in from Tampa, Florida. So must be listening in online. Go ahead, Amare. Welcome. You're on the exchange.
Thank you very much. Hey, Willard, how you doing?
Hey.
Good. Thanks for letting me know about the show. Very nice show. My question is, it seems from the topic that you're having that the NAACP, I guess, is different chapter to chapter. And, you know, we in Brooklyn, I mean, I am from Brooklyn, as you know, like we don't see on major issues, you know, that befall the, you know, black people in Brooklyn, we don't see the NAACP at the head of those issues. We don't see the NAACP leading charges on any particular, you know, major kinds of issues. I'm glad to hear that you said that up in New Hampshire that, you know, you're dealing with issues such as voter suppression and voters' rights and things of that nature. So but my question is the NAACP evolving or is it devolving?
Okay.
Exactly, you know,
okay.
just from your position, where is it?
Okay. Well, and Mara, I'm going to let you go. I apologize. We're heading towards the end. But go ahead, Willard. We talked about this a little bit earlier, sort of keeping it fresh and relevant.
Well, you know, and it depends on the local branches. If our caller is a member of the Brooklyn NAACP, then he has a voice and he has the opportunity to move that branch in the direction that it's going. And that's why I agreed to be president this year, because I want to help make this group, organization be what it can be and what it needs to be for the community.
All right. Willard Lett, we've run out of time. I can't believe it. Thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
That's Willard Lett, president of Manchester's NAACP. He's been with the organization for about 20 years, took over as president back in January. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. I'm Laura Knoy.